Hey, Eric here. Just a quick heads up that starting next week, Thinking LSAT on YouTube will publish to the LSAT Demon channel instead of to the separate Thinking LSAT channel. If you're just listening on your favorite podcast app, don't worry, nothing will change for you. But if you like watching the show on YouTube, check out the LSAT Demon channel for future episodes of Thinking LSAT, along with our daily podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. Thanks, and enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to episode 426 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Ben Olson and with me is Nathan Fox. We're the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. Be LSAT famous, share news and ask questions on our website, thinkinglsat.com, or send a voice recording of your question to help@thinkinglsat.com. Record in a quiet place and keep it to under 30 seconds.
And by the way, yes, that is the way to skip the line. If you would like to have your question answered preferentially, follow those instructions, send us a nice voice recording, and we'll definitely respond quickly.
Okay, everybody's going to use that now. Sounds good.
Well, only one person is going to be able to get the shortcut. So
yeah,
if your question is not selected, I'm sorry.
Monday, November 13th at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, I'm going to be doing my regular class. But then, Nathan, you're going to join at the end around 1:45, I think, and we're going to do some logical reasoning together. I will be doing reading comp by myself. Then Nathan will join. Why are we doing logical reasoning?
So we're doing extra logical reasoning because starting in August, the law school admission test is going to include extra logical reasoning. The games are going away and we're going to have twice as much LR. So our classes at LSAT Demon Live are going to be moving in that. Of course, the people who are studying now are still studying games hard. You know, it's a big opportunity to try to perfect your games if you're going to take one of the next four administrations of the test, or five, I guess. But if you are planning to take the test in August 2024 and beyond, you're not going to need games. You're going to need to be really good at logical reasoning, because logical reasoning is now going to be 2/3 of the test.
Great. Thursday, November 23rd at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, you're going to have your free class. That's always the same?
My class is always a bit of everything. Yeah, we do a little bit of logical reasoning, a little bit of games, a little bit of reading comprehension, and that'll change slowly over time. You know, I'll drop the games from my classes when we get to that last games test, June of 2024. Until then, I think everybody needs to see it as a big opportunity to, you know, have one section of the test that they know they can ace. And I'm going to miss that, right? Like, we've had the luxury the last few years of a lot of our students are just rolling into the test knowing that they're going to score perfect on the games. So
that
gravy train is going away. But logical reasoning is its own gravy train.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. You can sign up for these classes at lsat.link/free, or just go to lsatdemon.com and get a free demon account. Great. Let's jump into this first email from Amanda.
Yeah, it says, help. I desperately need to know what you think about this change. Does having the logic game section dropped change your advice to study without a timeline, especially given that it's the most easily improvable section? I'm not sure one has anything to do with the other. Well, I guess we just used to say, don't take the LSAT until you're perfect on the games.
Yeah.
We're not going to be able to say that anymore after June of 2024.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is somewhat related, right? This Amanda's wondering, hey, look, maybe I can get this to -0.
Oh, to put it on a timeline because she thinks she can knock it out of the park before June of 2024.
Yeah, or by June. Yeah.
She says, I've been studying pretty much full time since August and first started studying in 2008. Parentheses, no joke. I obviously haven't been studying that whole time, but my next attempt will be my third, as I took the test in 2009 and 2019 as well.
I was just going to say your 2009 attempt is not going to count towards your five, but
yeah, five times in 5 years. I mean, the 2019 test is barely counting in her five, or she's, that one's about to expire in another year.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. I just don't know if I should bag the section altogether and wait, or keep going, but potentially wasting time by practicing the games. All right, so it is, yeah, she's wanting to know, should I just push to August of 2024?
Yeah.
I do feel like I'm on the brink of the click, as I've got a pretty good foundation laid and I'm planning to sign up for a paid LSAT Demon subscription as soon as I get a fee waiver. My practice test score has gone up by 7 points recently with just my self-study, and I know I'm going to improve quickly and dramatically as soon as I have full access to all the wonderful resources you all provide. Oh, wow. That's very kind of you, Amanda. She's got a whole bunch of hashtags here. Hashtag lawyer by 40. Hashtag never give up. Hashtag don't judge my grammar too hard. I'm a little buzzed while typing this. And hashtag old and hopefully LSAT famous. Amanda's having fun with her email to us. What do you think, Ben? Should Amanda push for perfection on the games and take the LSAT this spring, or should she decide that she's gonna ignore the games? Or is there a middle ground? Should she maybe be doing a little bit of both? Or what I mean by that is, should she plan on taking the test across the transition period? Because there does seem to be kind of an opportunity for people who aren't sure. Sometimes they ace the game, yeah. Sometimes they don't.
Yeah. No, I think you're the one who originally floated this idea, and I think it applies here to Amanda and a lot of people. Yes, in theory, there's some value in just hyper-focusing on LR and reading comp, right? Like, stop wasting time with games if you're not going to take the test until August. At the same time, look, we still have a lot of time until the June test, so study the games. If you see yourself making significant progress and it's not that challenging for you, then do it and then plan on taking the test twice.
I agree.
Yeah.
We see people go from single digits on the games to perfect on the games. It can go from your least favorite section to your favorite section.
Yeah.
And it can happen in a snap. Do we think that that's going to happen for Amanda? I guess we don't really know what she's been doing on all these previous attempts. Yeah. You know, we think our way is different and better. Amanda seems to agree. Maybe with us, she'll make like a quick, like finally find that click, like make it make sense.
Yep.
If you're already feeling that, then I guess that's a pretty good sign.
Yeah. I just don't think there's a huge downside to getting good at all three sections. Because if you ultimately never get the best you could get at games and you decide that you, well, hey, I'm just going to take it without the games, fine. You're still going to be good at LR and reading comp because you had to develop those skills.
Yeah, and getting good at the games, I think, pretty clearly makes you also better at logical reasoning. There are logical reasoning questions that are, you know, conditional premises linked together, just like on the games, there's conditional rules that link together.
Yeah.
And there are certainly parallels there. So unless you're like totally paralyzed by the games, you know, like you've tried it for a little bit and you're totally paralyzed, I guess for some of those students I could say, okay, maybe we should just wait until, but you'd have to, you know, I guess I've never seen anybody who's really like that, right? If you're good enough at, if you're sort of naturally attuned to the logical reasoning and the reading comprehension, then the games can be unfamiliar and difficult and weird at first, but they are, you quickly learn because you have the reading ability, the detail, like focusing on the, you know, like actually understanding what it says in those premises. As soon as the translation is like kind of obvious, and then those people tend to improve really quickly on the games anyway.
Yeah. And you said it, but for so many people, the game section goes from their least favorite section to their most favorite section, which actually gave me an idea when I was driving home 2 days ago.
What's that?
After August or after June of 2024, we're going to be saying goodbye to the games. But do we need to say goodbye, goodbye. Couldn't we maybe drop in a game every now and then while someone's drilling?
Oh, that's fine. Break? Yeah, no, that's cool. Yeah, that's great, actually. Oh, we can start using them as like, using them as like a to gamify the LSAT, right?
Exactly.
Otherwise, yeah, we're going to lose. Yeah,
the game. It's a literal game.
Love it. Yeah, I can't wait. Obviously, that we would have the ability to toggle that off, and it might even
turn it
by
off.
Default start as off.
Yeah.
But yeah, we can throw it in there and see if people like it. They can easily unsubscribe if they want to. Love it.
It's kind of like meditating, right?
Yeah, like just like the meditation. Yeah.
Periodically, like, hey, take a break. Have some fun with this. This is a throwback.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, fantastic. Great idea. Love it.
Okay.
Is that enough for Amanda, do we think?
Yeah. Yeah. Good luck. Let us know what you decide.
Good luck, Amanda. Next one is, okay, so we've got apparently a few of them about personal statement topics.
Okay.
Why don't you start with Kayla? Apparently, Kayla is a nurse turned lawyer.
Hi, I've been working as an ER nurse for 3 years now, and I'm applying to law school. Yeah, that's a big shift. Kayla continues, nursing is no longer what I want to do long term, so I decided to make this switch. I have just about everything aligned to apply for this cycle, but I still feel unsure of myself. I went to a top 20 university, but don't care about rankings for law school. I'm taking the LSAT again in November, but so far I have a 155 and 3.5 GPA. I've always enjoyed school and putting in a lot of work, but I'm struggling to explain why law school in my personal statement. I just have to stop here, Kayla. I think you're worried about the wrong things. Like, you're worried about saying this in your personal statement, but you need to work on your LSAT. And actually, I'm more concerned about you answering this question for yourself, not for your personal statement. Like, why law school? Anyways, I'll keep reading what Kayla says. As transparent as I would like to be in explaining nursing burnout and the hardships I deal with daily on the job, I know many stay within this environment and thrive, but it's become too hard for me. I don't know how to properly articulate this within my personal statement. I want to stay within healthcare, but feel like I don't know enough about healthcare law. How do you guys think I should address the why from my personal statement? What do you know about healthcare law? Is law school practical for me? Wow, I'm just going to double down on what I was saying earlier. It feels like Kayla is leaving nursing, but that does not say to me that then Kayla should go into law. Those are two totally different decisions.
Yeah, she like went to the train station and just got on. She's just getting on a train without like thinking about the destination. It's like,
yeah,
well, I just want to be out of here.
I hate this city. I'm gone. Okay, where are you going?
Right. So I would encourage her to think of this through a little more. I think she's putting the cart way ahead of the horse by thinking about her law school personal statement. Although it is good that it has her thinking about why law for her.
Yeah, because that's important.
I don't know anything about healthcare law. Do you know anything about healthcare law?
Nope.
So
robust, I'm sure.
But you need to talk to lawyers who know about healthcare law. If that's what you think you want to do, you need to be talking to healthcare lawyers. So the hospital that you were working at has lawyers. They might use outside counsel, but you should be able to figure out who your lawyers are and maybe go talk to them.
Yep.
You, as a nurse, I bet you have union lawyers. You could probably go talk to those lawyers because they like actually represent you. You can use LinkedIn, pound the pavement, use your contacts. You're a little bit older, I think. Yeah, well, it must be because you've been practicing for a while. So you're a little bit older. You know, maybe you've got friends who have some connections that you can track down, but you need to go talk to people who actually do this work. And then they can tell you whether it's practical for you. Maybe they can help you decide whether it's practical for you.
Yeah.
Don't over explain why you're leaving nursing, though. If you're like, if you do end up actually applying to law school, which You're saying I have just about everything aligned to apply for this cycle other than like, do I want to do this? Because you don't have any idea what you're getting yourself into. Yeah, I think you should. I think you just need to slow it down, probably by a full cycle. But you gotta start making some of those contacts.
Here's another idea, and I think a lot of people have this. Kayla writes, as transparent as I would like to be. Like, people feel like obligated to explain everything about themselves, or they explain what might be considered skeletons in their closet. It's like, no, the law schools aren't asking you, tell me everything that happened, or this really awkward thing. Well, they just want to know.
In like, particular, why it's like everybody wants to focus on the worst things.
Yeah, exactly. Like
you leaving nursing, Kayla, is kind of sad. Okay. I mean, everything that you tell us in this email is that burnout, hardships, can't handle it. Well, that's not, you know, you're not, that's not ever going to be presenting an attractive package to anybody. You need to be like clearer about what you do want to do. Mm-hmm. And then you can talk about that. I mean, I think you could tell them what they want to hear in this case. It's not that hard. You clearly, Kayla, what you definitely want to do is work within healthcare law. Specifically, you want to do something and you can, I don't know, maybe it is the nursing labor issues that you think are interesting. Maybe it's the malpractice that you think is interesting. Maybe it's some other area that you think is interesting. Doesn't even really matter. It's just that those are real lawyers who have actual jobs doing that shit. You are kind of, you know, your history, your resume makes that story make sense. And then you present to them that story on your personal statement. You just show how the shit that you've actually done makes sense in the context of this thing that you're applying to do. And but you don't talk about the burnout and the how you hated it and all that stuff. That doesn't in any way benefit you.
Yeah. Well, and I think one thing that Kayla and a lot of people need to understand is that if you want to go to law school and you want to do these particular things, it is not inconsistent to want to do those things, to go to law school and pursue this healthcare law, and also be someone who loved your job as a nurse and killed it. Like, it's totally possible for someone to be an amazing nurse, love their job, and say, you know what? And now I'm going to move to the next phase of my career. So
and
I
that's the impression that I would rather have of you. If yes, I'm looking exactly. to admit you into yeah. my law school, I want the nurse who is just so proud of the work that she did and even more, you know, optimistic about what law school is going to do for her. She's going to make an even bigger impact.
She's going to add to her career rather than run away right. from one. I think people feel like I have to explain why I'm going to law school. It doesn't make sense. Why would I be leaving what I'm doing now and going somewhere else? It's like there's so many reasons and they don't have to be. I hated it.
No, it's the exact opposite of that. It's yeah. Law school is the natural progression of where my career has been headed. In my role as an ER nurse, I was involved yeah. in this and that, or, you know, whatever. Like there were, you know, I saw the labor negotiations with the hospital. And so this is the obvious, I don't know. It's just not that hard.
Yeah.
Right. Like there yep. was a patient of ours and the doctor that I worked for got a malpractice lawsuit and blah, blah, blah. You can say that you were interested, concerned, and you see law school as this, you know, and by the way, you know, you've talked to lawyers who do this kind of work. You know what that field looks like. You want to do that exact, you know, that's the thing you're yeah. going to do.
Yeah.
And it doesn't all have to be true. You don't, it's the future. We can't predict what's going to be actually happening 4 years from now when you get closer to graduation from law school. We don't know what you're going to actually be doing. And they know that you don't know what you're actually going to be doing. But all this is advocacy. It's just tell yeah. a better story for yourself. Somebody's going to yeah. look at this piece of paper for 45 seconds and they're going to have made judgments about you.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, but don't tell me about hardships and burnout and those kinds of things. You just need to be saying, oh yeah, this makes perfect sense. I'm so happy to be embarking on this next totally logical phase of my career. That said, this actual plan seems completely half-cocked. Like, I don't think, right? Because she's asking us about healthcare law.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know. I don't know. I assume that, as Ben said, I assume that it is a robust area of law. And I'm sure that there are many, many lawyers making lots and lots of money on both sides of it, or on all sides of it, right? It's huge business.
So, but even if they are, boy, becoming a practicing attorney is a big shift.
Huge.
For anyone. Especially it's enormous. For someone coming from healthcare, which is just on your feet, hands-on, working with people every day.
Even in the emergency room.
Yeah.
Like
you're going to go to documents and...
it's a fighting. wildly different life full of just people who are talented in completely opposite things.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. Two pieces of advice then for Kayla. One is, for your own self, go talk to these lawyers so that you can make a plan.
Yep.
And by the way, be open to the possibility that when you talk to these lawyers, you're going to realize that you don't want to do that.
Yep.
And then in that case, you're just going to go talk to other lawyers and see if you want to do what they do. Or you're going to decide you don't want to be a lawyer. But at some point, you've got to be like, yeah, I'm excited about this particular field of law. And I've talked to those people. I know what those people are like. I know what they look like.
Yeah.
I know roughly, you know. So you need to do that. And then if you're really convinced, if you decide that you're convinced that you really do want to go to law school, then the LSAT is where it's at. I mean, your personal statement, keep it positive. Let's start talking about your LSAT though. Right. And if you walk in with a 165 or a 170, you are telling a very different story to those law schools than if you walk in with a 155. Very, very different. With the 155, you're going to be walking in, you know, I guess you're at the median at some schools, but you're below the median at a lot of schools. With a 165 or a 170, you just transform, Kayla, your application. And that is far more important than the why that shows up in your personal statement. Should we move on to Anonymous?
Yeah, we should. So the next one from Anonymous is on personal statement about ADHD.
Hello, Ben and Nathan. I was recently diagnosed with severe ADHD. It's been a life-altering experience, understanding that a lot of the things I experience on a daily basis are symptoms of my ADHD. My diagnosis has even opened my eyes to realizing why I love public speaking, why I love writing, and probably why I want to become a lawyer. Because of this, I think I could write a compelling personal statement about my diagnosis and how it relates to me wanting to pursue law. Should I write my personal statement on this topic? I've heard that law schools don't want to consider your LSAT score as legitimate if they found out you received extra time accommodations for it, which I did. Will writing my personal statement affect my chances of admissions because law schools will interpret my LSAT as non-representative of my actual skills? Thank you. I wanted to share that I've improved my LSAT from a 148 to a 171 with the Demon. 23 points improvement. That's obviously not just the result of accommodations. But law schools know that accommodations could have been worth 5, 6, 7, 8 points. And their gap between their 25th percentile and their 75th percentile LSAT is pretty small. That might mean that they actually don't even care that you got accommodations because they're just, you're the number is good, then the number makes them look good.
Hmm.
But on the margins, if they really are like making a final decision, you know, we've got too many qualified applicants. Your numbers are all roughly the same. We're trying to decide who to admit or deny, or we're trying to decide who to offer the full ride to and who not to offer the full ride to.
Yeah.
On those margins, if you have disclosed to them something that they had no other way of knowing about you, which is your diagnosis, they can very reasonably infer that you're probably got extra time accommodations on the LSAT. And yep. I think they are very likely going to discriminate against you in that case. even if it's only subconscious. What do you think, Ben?
No, I have to agree, in part because the U.S. News rankings has given more weight to employability and things like that, which means
I didn't think that through, really. I think that's astute. I do. Yeah. It's like, how can they possibly judge employability, you know, LSAT, GPA?
Yeah. Yep.
Resume, I guess they could start preferring people with work experience.
Yep.
And I would have to think that if you disclose to them this diagnosis and that you were accommodated for this disability, I can't imagine them thinking, oh, that enhances this candidate's employability.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine them thinking the opposite or just getting colored by it without even knowing, you know, without, they could be best of intentions and, oh, well, we don't want to discriminate against this person because of that. But who knows what they're actually deciding on at the final cut.
So we're focusing on whether the schools will discriminate against this applicant based on the fact that they reveal their ADHD. And it seems like there's a probable yes there. But also, I'm not sure that this topic makes sense. Like, you're going to talk about how your diagnosis helped you realize why you love public speaking, why you love writing, and probably why I want to become a lawyer. It doesn't seem like it seems like flowery. I would just
to me, that was just, I wanted an example.
Yeah.
Like, what are the things that you experience on a daily life that are symptoms of your ADHD that you like had this epiphany about?
Yeah.
And then especially I want to know, what do you mean it opened your eyes to realizing why you love public speaking, why you love writing? You can't just state that, because that's just like a conclusion. You know, you have to sort of explain yourself there. And if you did, if you had a great explanation, then I guess I could see it making some sort of sense. But I really wouldn't disclose the diagnosis. I can't imagine that being the best way to go. You know, it's like, because you're also like saying, yeah, I got special accommodations on the test. And so, of course, you're going to be granting me these same special accommodations if I come to your school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's how they are going to perceive it, right?
Yeah.
That you're going to feel, I don't know. I could be completely wrong. I hope I'm wrong. I hope that people have a bigger heart, I guess, than that. But, you know, I think that there's going to be a lot of people who are like, hey, people are out there taking advantage of the system. So many people are getting accommodations these days. We don't know what scores are real anymore. And if you know, it's like an own goal sort of,
mm-hmm.
By just disclosing something that they have no other way of knowing.
Yeah.
And I don't think it can really help you very much. So I would just write about other stuff. I mean, sounds like you have some public speaking experience. Sounds like you have some writing experience. Write about that stuff. I don't see why you have to bring the ADHD into it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Lots of different ways that people can craft these things. It's like, I don't know. You just need to keep it positive and make it look, you want to show yourself as somebody that this school is going to be like, oh yeah, got to have that person.
Yeah.
Next one up is from Kamal. It says, the subject is controversial application.
I planned on using my personal statement to talk about my Palestinian heritage and how that has contributed to a unique and possibly rare school of thought that can enrich a university that celebrates intellectual diversity. That doesn't sound like a personal statement topic, but that sounds like a diversity statement topic.
That's absolutely, yeah.
Kamal continues, however, the recent current events between Israel and Palestine that took place and the horror that has transpired has formed a black cloud and a controversy where even mentioning the topic can unintentionally seem as having certain judgment on the situation. Yeah, certainly. You talk about it and people think you're on one side or the other. Kamal says, I compare it to the Trump controversy surrounding the 2016 media, where it seemed better to keep your political beliefs away from your professional life. However, it differs in the matter that this is an ethnic and racial view that I should be able to highlight without feeling pressured of controversy. But the matter of fact is, I'm debating on scratching the idea of ethnic focus and instead talk about potential goals. However, I'm also wondering if I can use this to my strength. Does having my specific school of thought matter now more than ever? Would T14 schools who encourage diversity that I would have had a low chance of acceptance based on stats appreciate my points of view? I don't think it's going to help much. This is the main issue I have. Is speaking about the current events and my ethnic ties a red flag or a potential selling point? Your guys' thoughts on this would be amazing. I've been in my head about it for weeks, and I really appreciate the realism answers you guys always give.
I think it's fine to talk about this. I think you should talk about it in your diversity statement. I think that's exactly the place for it. I don't think you want to be talking about a lot of your opinions, though. I think you want to be talking about your racial and ethnic background
and
how your own experience and how you only want to talk about it to the extent that it's relevant to something in, like, how's it relevant to what you've been able to achieve academically? How's it relevant to what you've been able to achieve professionally? And I think that they're clear that they do want you to talk about that stuff. I don't think you need to shy away from mentioning that you're Palestinian. That would be insane if we're in a world where you can't. I mean, no, they want to know about racial, ethnic, religious. They want to know about different kinds of diversity. So you can go ahead and write about that stuff. I don't think that's your personal statement at all. I think your personal statement is something else. Who are you as a lawyer? Who are you as a student, an academic, or a working person? Who are you? Maybe your goals a little bit, but I would be more interested in what you've actually been able to achieve. You know, what am I getting out of the deal? Who is this person who's going to come to my campus? What are they going to actually be contributing? And like, your opinions on the Middle East are not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for lawyers.
Yep.
So write about your diverse background in your diversity statement and write about lawyer shit in your personal statement. Anything else?
I think that's good.
All right.
Next one is from Reagan. The subject is drilling. Always missing one question.
I'm going to call it Regan because it's R-E-G-A-N. I could be wrong.
Okay.
Always, huh? Missing one question. I've noticed when I drill that I seem to always miss just one question when it comes to LG and RC. Oh, so one per game, one per passage. I get it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Even if I feel I have a strong understanding of the passage or game, I still seem to miss one question. What do you recommend I do to get over this little hump? I have yet to start doing timed sections because I feel like I need to get better at drilling first. Thanks, Regan.
Well, one thing to keep in mind about drilling is that when you do get all the questions right over time, the drilling tool is going to give you harder questions. So you're always going to be missing some. Maybe that's why you feel like it. Because if you're always getting 100% accuracy in drilling and you're doing them within a reasonable time, then you're not being challenged, right? So on some level. So I don't know if I would read too much into that. I do think you're putting maybe too much emphasis on perfecting drilling before doing a timed section. Just do a timed section. See how it goes there.
Yeah, you should be doing timed sections so that you can learn to ignore the clock. You're not going to learn how to ignore the clock unless you start timing yourself. So you need to be doing that regularly. I think from the very beginning of your prep, I think you can start with a timed section. You can also start with just one question, and that's what drilling does. But at some point, you got to bite the bullet and say, you know, I have 35 uninterrupted minutes to devote to this right now. I'm going to see what it's like to do a timed section. You have to start doing that. And don't race the clock. You're not trying to finish. You're just going to do your thing while being timed.
Yeah.
And if you don't start practicing those, then you're just going to build it up and up and up to be more and more stressful. You got to stop doing that. So you say you're always missing one on games and on reading comp. It's a sign of you're not being careful enough. I mean, the games, you should be able to answer every single question with certainty. Just don't move on until you know you have answered the question correctly. For everyone that you're getting right, for everyone that you're getting wrong there, I think you're probably also kind of half guessing another one right. I think that that's just on the games. I think it's a bad sign of inattention. I mean, it's better than missing two or three, but when you're missing one, you don't have to miss any. So you're being sloppy there, and you've got to just figure out why it is that you're missing those questions. It's lack of attention. You're not actually solving the question. You're kind of guessing. And I don't know exactly why, but that's what's happening. On reading comp, sometimes people get limited by their vocabulary a little bit, I think. You know, there's going to be places in reading comp where there's a word in an answer choice. Like, it's a correct answer, but there's a word in it that you just don't understand. And so then you have to, like, try to get it right by process of elimination. It can be a little bit tougher. But still, if you're always missing one, then that accuracy is not that great, right? That's like 80% accurate or 85% accurate or something. It's okay. Good, but not great. I think you should thoroughly review your mistakes. Any other advice for Regan?
No. Yeah.
Thanks for writing in, Regan. Next one up is from Anonymous. The subject is Hitchens Razor.
The writer Christopher Hitchens came up with a saying that is now called Hitchens Razor. It states, what can be asserted without evidence can also be dismissed without evidence. Do you think this could be a useful mindset for the LSAT in general and LR in particular? I mean, I guess it's true that there are some questions in which the conclusion says something is false without providing any evidence, or providing evidence that's not relevant or very weak evidence. I don't know what to take away from this.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I mean, like, I do expect answer choices to be wrong. And so I feel like dismissing answer choices without evidence is kind of a thing on the LSAT. Right. It's like,
yeah, you don't explain exactly why it's wrong, but you're like, OK, not good enough for me, at least on the surface. So I'm going to assume it's wrong.
I do think we need to talk about the difference there between the open record questions and closed record questions.
OK, like
if this is a must be true, mm-hmm. it's a closed record. I'm picking an answer that's based on the facts. So yep. if an answer choice starts talking about some shit that wasn't in the facts, I dismiss it. I don't need really more evidence to dismiss that answer. I just get to let go of it because it's like, that's something new. Goodbye.
Yeah.
I can't really do that though on, say, a weakened question, because a weakened question says which one of the following, if true, would undermine the argument. So there I have to like actually consider the truth of the answer, then see if it has bearing. And so I'm not going to be dismissing those without, well, I guess I still am dismissing it without evidence. If I read it and I go, I don't see how that has any bearing on the conclusion of this argument.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause what you're saying is you're like, I don't see the connection. And so someone might ask you to go further and explain, okay, why exactly does it not connect? And what you're saying is, no, the fact that I don't see a connection is good enough. I don't need to explain it to myself.
Right. Like sometimes students get frustrated because I'll say, well, this doesn't connect to the argument. It's not even trying to weaken the argument. It's talking about some other thing. And it's like, well, but explain why it's wrong. Well, it's wrong because it doesn't have any bearing. It just doesn't do anything to the argument. I don't know. I feel like I kind of talk myself in circles there sometimes trying to explain why it doesn't weaken. I don't know. It doesn't weaken because it doesn't weaken. Explain to me why it does weaken.
Yeah. I mean, I can understand that desire. It's almost like you have to figure out why they think it's connected and then explain explicitly right. why it's not, yeah, which course, makes yeah. sense after the test. But what you're saying, and I think this is what we do in practice so often, is during the test, there are so many answers that we're not sitting there going, well, let me tell you exactly why that's wrong. It's just like, I already like B a lot. And right. I'm not instantly seeing why D could work. So I'm going to move on. And people are like, yeah, but why is that wrong? It's like, You only need to do that analysis during the test if you actually found D tempting.
Right. And if students tell us why they find that answer tempting, then we can tell them why it's wrong. But yeah. in real life, like at actual speed, I'm not going through every single answer choice thinking like, well, if I misinterpreted this in this way, then maybe it could possibly have bearing. Or if I, you know, like I don't have to sit there and like think deeply about how it possibly could matter, because on a first pass through the answer choices, especially.
Yeah,
I'm just basically saying, unless you're what I'm looking for, or unless I see how you are clearly doing the thing that needs doing here, I'm just presuming that you're gone.
Yeah.
Right. I'm going to assume you're out. I don't know if that's actually relevant to this Hitchens razor idea.
Thanks for writing in. Yeah. Here's an ask button question about a parallel reasoning question.
Says the correct answer is not in the same order as the way the passage is laid out, which took me a while to figure out. How can we quickly determine what order to put the premises in to deduce the flow of reasoning when doing a parallel reasoning question?
I feel like this person is overly focused on the structure. Obviously, the structure is often similar and related to the underlying reasoning, but what order it comes in doesn't matter so much. What you need to understand is what kind of evidence did the person use originally to draw what kind of conclusion, and then you just figure out whether the evidence in the new argument follows the same pattern, not the order, but like how the premises relate to each other, right, and then how they ultimately relate to the conclusion, right? And that's a much more intuitive process than a lot of people make it out to be at first.
Let me try a shorter answer to this question, which is,
sure,
in your head, put the conclusion last.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Like because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if they said their conclusion first, then two premises, or if they said a premise, their conclusion, and another premise, or if they said premise, conclusion. But I would always rearrange the argument so that it's premise, conclusion, or sometimes I might actually say the conclusion first and then say premise, and then say the conclusion again to see, to be clear, like, okay, so I know what they're trying to prove. Now here's their evidence. And then, that does it or does not prove their conclusion. But I think that the simple trick for students, if you're doing a parallel question and you think, oh, this answer might be correct, or it does seem to be a similar type of logic, but it's got the elements out of order. Well, then you're allowed to just rearrange it in your mind however you want, because it literally doesn't matter what sentence was first or second or third. All that matters is, what are they trying to conclude, and was there evidence there that was supporting that conclusion? Because it is true that on parallel reasoning questions, there will be answers that are correct that have the elements in some other different order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this question, how can we quickly determine what order to put the premises in to deduce the flow of the reasoning? It still feels like this person is more concerned about the structure having something
like
to do with the flow.
Right? Like, well, wait, was that the first premise or was that the first premise? Like, well,
yeah,
no,
diagramming,
it doesn't really
matter. Or even just like trying to, like, if I say to you, for example, that, hey, there are three types of milk in this universe. Non-fat, 1%, 2%. Obviously, there are more than that nowadays, but let's just say those three, right? And I say, look, non-fat tastes like shit, and 2% is not available at the store. Therefore, I'm going to have to buy 1%. Okay, so I gave you three options. I eliminated two of them, and then I reached a conclusion.
Yep.
Just understand that. Your mind doesn't actually care about the order in which that is thrown at you. Right.
If you say a parallel argument would be like, I have to play the Santa Barbara Muni tomorrow.
Yep.
Because Sandpiper's closed and I can't afford La Cumbra. And the only three choices that I have are the Muni, Sandpiper, and La Cumbra.
Exactly. Exactly. And the order is totally different. You started with your conclusion. You might have even reordered the premises, actually. I think you did it almost in an exact opposite order, but I don't remember. It doesn't matter. What matters is that you intuitively understand, hey, I had three options, two were eliminated, therefore I'm left with one. I need an argument that does something similar, however the hell it does that. And that's so much easier, right? When looking for that, than looking for like, okay, so I need three options. Where's the three options? What order? Oh, okay, I'm going to put that up at the top. Like, don't even think about that. Just read the whole thing.
Yeah, you're looking to match the overall vibes of the argument. You know, it's just like you should be able to see that spark of, oh, they're doing the same type of thing here. And in that case, it was, well, they said they had three options and they ruled out two of them and they concluded that they have to do the third one. Assuming that they have to do one of the three options, that's actually valid logic. If they didn't have to do one of the three three options, then it would be incomplete logic. You'd be assuming that you're choosing one of the three.
Yeah.
But that would be like what the question's actually going to be probing at, right?
Yeah,
like
does the same thing. Yeah.
At a higher level, there'll be like, well, it was three options. It was ruling out two of them. And it did make the assumption that you have to pick one of the three assumptions. One of the three options. Something like that, where it'll be like, well, but this one didn't have that assumption. That's why it's wrong.
Yeah.
That's when you get to the higher levels. But it's still just, it really has nothing to do with the order. It's just what's the type of reasoning that's being employed. But I think fast tip that I maybe is on target here is just if you're not sure, find the conclusion, make sure you're focused on the conclusion. And then probably in your head, you can order it, like put the premises, doesn't matter what premise is first, but like what's their evidence? And then now, okay. And then does that evidence prove this conclusion? The conclusion is the last thing. And that might help you to identify matching answers.
Cool. Here's an ask button question about drilling specific question types.
Cool. Says, I'm not fully there on necessary and sufficient assumptions. I think I'm making progress, but still not confident in it, especially the level 4 and higher questions. Do you think it would benefit me to do my off day like 30 to 60 minutes a day of necessary and sufficient questions?
I don't think it can hurt. I'm not quite sure I understand that part of it, but
should you do 30 to 60 minutes of just sufficient and necessary assumption questions?
I don't think there's a problem with that. I think the problem that people have, and this is what we do not want people to do, is to pick one question type and then drill it. But I think there can be a lot of value in, especially when you're talking about necessary and sufficient assumption questions, to do those two together. And to start getting much better at one, recognizing which is which, because that's mistake number one that a lot of people make. They're like, oh, here, I'm going to do this sufficient assumption question. It's like, yeah, actually, that's a necessary assumption question. So let's get that cleared up. And then you can start to see how they're different and how they're similar. Another pair of question types that could be drilled together are strengthening questions and supported questions.
Totally. That's exactly what I was just going to say. Specifically, strengthen and supported. The reason is that the wording of those can be shockingly similar sometimes, but they're asking you to do two very different things. On a strengthening question, they're asking you to change the game. The record's open. Which answer, if true, is going to do something? And on supported questions, it's which one of these answers is supported by the passage that you were given? The record is closed and you have to find one answer that is like, no, I've got the goods. It said it in the passage. That's why I'm picking this answer. But they can use a lot of the same language, and students can confuse those two wildly different question types. Any other good pairs for drilling side by side?
Yeah, you could do weaken and flaw together, or because sometimes people get those mixed up. But
those are
also
the difference between open and closed record, right? Weaken questions is an open record. Which one of these, if it's true, weakens the argument? Flaw question is a closed record. Which one is a flaw that is inherent in that reasoning? So you've got to be able to show, you know, okay, there it is. They definitely did this thing and it's a problem that they did it. That's why I'm picking this answer. So weaken and flaw. Yeah, that's another good one.
But the point here is that you're doing two or more question types together as opposed to just doing one, because when you do just one, for whatever reason, you know exactly what you're going to be asked. People stop thinking about, oh, okay, the passage. They just know the question. They don't even read the question. It's just not a great way to study.
Yeah.
Cool. The next one is from Nolan. The subject is law school admissions perception on lower LSAT scores.
Says, hey guys, you guys helped me get from my diagnostic score of a 140 to a 161. Thanks again. However, my practice tests were oscillating between 165 and 168, and I registered for the September and October tests in hopes of scoring higher. I decided to forego the preview slash cancel score option, and I would like your guys' opinion on how law school admissions view lower test scores. Is it simply irrelevant and they will only care about the highest, or am I taking a small risk in taking the test a couple more times with the possibility of scoring lower? Wow. Thanks again for all the astute advice concerning the LSAT. I think we can probably give Nolan the most concrete, obviously helpful advice of anyone else that we talked to on this entire podcast.
Yeah, don't worry about your lowest score. They're not going to care unless you're applying to Canada
schools. Also, the upside is so high for you. You have practice tests oscillating between 165 and 168. You need to be excited about the upside here. If you get even a 165, it transforms your application. 161 to 165 is a huge difference. And a 161 to a 168 is an even huger difference. And if it's anything in between, it's nothing but a win, right? A 162 is a clear win.
Yeah.
And a 160 or a 159, one, very unlikely given your practice test scores. Two, they're not going to care. They're only going to care about the highest score unless you're applying to a school that averages, which is some but not all schools in Canada.
Nolan, I think these numbers are literal. Would you be willing to bet $200 to have the chance of winning $150,000?
Yeah, or the millions of dollars, the untold riches of a big law,
a better
career of Masters of the Universe type of, like, not that we're really talking about Yale kinds of scores here, but the difference between a 161 and a 168 is, it's not only the tuition scholarships.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's also going to transform the types of schools that Nolan should even be considering.
Yeah.
So you've got to be the upside here vastly outweighs the downside. There's a lot of obvious upside and the downside is just negligible.
Yep.
So you should exhaust your five attempts. I mean, you should keep prepping. You should try to get, you want the very best LSAT you can, because it's just worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's our whole mission for what we do.
Yep. Yeah.
I wanted you to read this last one.
Yeah.
Ben, I thought we'd wrap it up maybe with a shout out. I don't think we are. Well, I want to practice gratitude for our amazing teachers, students, everybody who works with us on the help team, development team, marketing, we've got so much help. And I saw this review that came in from one of our live classes, and I wanted to why don't you give it a read?
Sure. So the rating was 5 out of 5, and the comment is, Eric is a great LG teacher. That's producer Eric. He takes the games step by step and really makes you think about how you split and why. He is always up for doing the games a different way, which helps me see even though you might split on something different, it will get you to the same answer. Eric is very patient and kind and always makes you feel like part of the class! I enjoy all of his classes, even if he can't say mauve, LOL. How do you say mauve, Eric? We'd love to know. We can get your audio recording here.
Mauve? Maybe that's the British way. I don't know. Dictionary.com agrees with me.
Eric is a great teacher. That's cool, because we do get these comments all the time.
Yeah, and I just wanted to take the opportunity to highlight one of our amazing teachers, and Eric, keep doing a great job. You also do a great job on the podcast, so we really appreciate all of your help.
Be LSAT famous. Please ask us questions or share news at thinkinglsat.com. If you have questions about the LSAT Demon, you can email help@lsatdemon.com. Check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 426 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing ya. Don't pay for law school.